One Inverness.
Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. I'm so glad you could tune in today. I'm going to be speaking today with our friend from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Martha Malico. She's an equine internal medicine specialist and biosecurity expert, and that's going to be our topic today, biosecurity, sort of proactive efforts to identify and prevent the spread of infectious disease. And we're hoping that you will enjoy the show today and maybe even later on, give us a call. Our phone number, 352-392-8989. We're going to be back after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and today is the 1st of October, 2016. And I'm really happy to welcome back to the program from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, our friend, the equine internal medicine specialist, Dr. Martha Malico. And we're going to be talking today about another area of her specialty, which is biosecurity. And this is a great demonstration today of a topic not only about which we really haven't been able to discuss on this show before, but about which I know virtually nothing. So those of you in the audience who look forward to me embarrassing myself more than usual, stay tuned. So welcome back to the show, Dr. Malico. I'm really glad to have you here. And I'm going to start with the sort of vaguest or broadest of questions. And just kind of ask you to give me a kind of working definition of biosecurity.
Sure. Well, I'm very glad to be back. First of all, we're always happy to come and get to chat with you guys on the radio. But certainly biosecurity in itself, if I were to give you a longer and more sophisticated answer, would be, you know, preventative efforts that are put in place to try to stop and identify the spread of infectious disease. But if you want to put it a little more simply, you can think of it as animal health security. You know, how do you keep the animals that you are taking care of and housing healthy if they were to be exposed to some sort of infectious disease at home or when traveling? And that's something that when it comes to our horse populations is tremendously important because we use our horses to be participating in so many things. You know, we travel with them. We take them off the property to show them. We take them off the property to go on trail rides and different things where they interact with a lot of other animals.
It sounds to me then like biosecurity in terms of equine veterinary medicine has its parallels in human medicine as well. The prevention of the spread of infectious disease, kind of the monitoring of that, is a very serious issue that many people in this country are devoted to passionately.
Absolutely. If you think about all the efforts that go into play to identify and prevent the spread of flu, for example, you know, there are tremendous amount of public health efforts every year to identify what flu strains are out there, how are they being transmitted, how many people are affected. Those same questions come into play with some of these equine diseases that are transmitted just as easily as human flu. And that's why we get worried about them when these horses are traveling and competing.
You mentioned traveling and competing. Are horses that don't do much traveling or competing sort of immune from caring about this?
Not necessarily. And it's intriguing to me because I have this conversation a lot with clients. They'll say, well, my horse never goes anywhere. He's not exposed to anything. And my question back is, well, where does your horse live? Oh, at a boarding barn, which means a barn where there are a lot of different horses, different owners. They all stay at the same place and someone manages the facility and takes care of them. Well, just because your horse doesn't travel anywhere, the one in the next stall that belongs to your friend from the barn may go every weekend on a trail ride. So your horse is then exposed as a secondary exposure to that animal that does travel. So even in a situation where your horse doesn't go anywhere, it is actually quite rare to find the truly, completely closed population on a barn where usually a small facility that someone's home, honestly, where none of the horses ever leave. Mm-hmm. And there's no opportunity for you to bring something back to them, for instance, on your own clothing or on yourself. Even horses that never leave the property, say a small farm with two or three horses, there's still people that come on the property. There's feed deliveries. There's farriers, which come to trim their feed. feet. They're veterinarians. And we'd like to think that all of those opportunities to bring something on the farm, those people are all careful and wouldn't do that. But still, the risk exists.
Well, so what's at stake here? I mean, are the lives of horses really in jeopardy with the spread of infectious disease that's kind of left unchecked or uncontrolled?
Sure. For the most part, we're not talking about things that will kill horses. There are a few. You know, I have a list of possible things, and a few of them could be that serious. But most of them are diseases that will put your horse out of training, put them out of work, potentially something you're going to have to nurse them back from health from for several weeks or a month. And so all of those things can have an impact. Now, the secondary issue is that if you have a breeding operation on your farm, you have mares that are bred every year, the opportunity for them to get infected sometimes can result in problems with those fetuses. And so it's another layer of concern. You know, is this a serious infection? Well, not in a horse that's not pregnant, but in a pregnant mare, it can be. So that's a second kind of layer of concern that we have in those animals.
So at the very least, it sounds like we're talking about problems that are, A, uncomfortable for horses themselves, right? I mean, a sickness of almost any kind with any severity at all is going to make a horse not feel very good. And also B, potentially a matter of economic importance, because treating a horse for a condition that might have been prevented in the first place is going to cost more than just preventing the disease. And then the potentially lost kind of activity that the horse might have been able to do, whether or not that would be something that might have been profitable, like breeding, or just sort of enjoyable for the horse owner.
Absolutely. And that is the majority of what we're talking about. There are several respiratory viral infections that horses can get. Flu does happen in the horse. It's a different strain. There's not a cross conversion of human to horse flu, at least that we've seen yet, thankfully. But we have a variety of respiratory viral infections, and what you see in the horse is very similar to what you see in people. Most people feel pretty cruddy for a couple days. They stay home from work. Well, that has an impact on their employer in that they're not able to do their job for that period of time. The same sorts of things happen with our horse patients. There's also a set of sort of GI infections, so gastrointestinal infections that can be transmitted from horse to horse that are in close contact. And those are things that can potentially make them sicker. It can give them really significant diarrhea. They can get quite ill with that. For the most part, they're not at risk of death, but very occasionally they can be. And those are not inexpensive things to treat. So all of these have some relevance.
I want to circle back around to the kind of expense associated with some of this a little bit later. But first, let me just kind of ask you if, you know, biosecurity, that seems like a kind of fancy, modern sounding term for something that at its core is kind of a basic idea, right? Mm-hmm. How long have veterinarians in particular been worried about this?
Well, you know, we have been worried about this for quite some time. You're right. It is a very basic question. How do we prevent the spread of infectious diseases? But I think what has brought this more into focus is as the competitive side of horses becomes a bigger world, we ship horses across the ocean to compete with regularity, which is not something that was done 50 years ago. If they were shipped, it was on a boat, not a plane, and that sort of thing. So there is just much more transitory nature of our equine population. So it makes it that much easier for a disease outbreak to become a big problem. And there are several examples of that in the past few years in the horse show world of a particular kind of respiratory virus. It is called the rhinovirus. Rhinopneumonitis has a couple different names, but it's a herpes virus that horses carry. And it has literally been the cause of shutting down multiple horse shows. And these are large competitions. So it's not just a fiscal issue, although there is a large economic impact, but also we're talking about competitions that people have been training the whole year to get to. And these horses are valuable. The horses, we don't want them to become ill, but also not being able to show and compete. Then they leave that show, go home, and then you have an opportunity to spread it even further. Because if it's a national competition, they're going home not around the corner, they're going home states away. So it really magnifies the problem.
I wonder, and you can certainly, I'd welcome if you feel I'm wrong to sort of counter my argument here or my analogy. But I think about something that's going on even in the state of Florida that has people concerned, and that is the Zika virus that has been really devastating in, say, the Caribbean and South America, where there is a lot of spread of mosquitoes that carry this, and people who spend a lot of time outdoors, and so they're exposed to it more often. And since it's a disease that can be spread not just by mosquitoes, but through different sorts of human contact, there are a frightening number of ways that this disease can move around. And so now we have seen, even in Florida, that there have been certainly travel-related cases, but also cases in which the disease was acquired even locally. And when you talk about then circumstances, we'll just go back in time to earlier this summer when some people were concerned and cautioning against having the Olympic Games in Brazil where potentially Zika could have spread. Now, in the end, I haven't really heard about any horror stories related to the Olympics and Zika, but be that as it may, is there any analogy between something like Zika in which public health officials and epidemiologists are watching the way that this is spread and concerned about the terrible adverse health effects that it can cause, and trying to then work with other officials to prevent further spread of the disease?
Absolutely. And I mean, that is the approach we would like to think would happen in any equine spread of disease as well. You know, there's a lot that's known about Zika. There's certainly many questions that remain. But what we do pretty well in the state of Florida is respond to mosquito-borne diseases. This is not the first type of mosquito-borne disease that humans have been at risk of problems with, and they have a pretty robust response system for that. The way they respond is set in place. And that's a really good example of how we would like things to occur with, say, for instance, an equine infectious disease outbreak. If a case is identified at a horse show or a sale or an area where many horses are kept closely together, there's a chain of things that occur after that that is a response that's, for the most part in Florida, coordinated by the state veterinarians, but also is coordinated by the people that are managing the show and the people that are competing at that event, and there is a coordinated response in an effort to prevent the spread. And that same response is something that someone can put into place at their own farm. You know, as they are monitoring for and identifying a potential problem, they can respond appropriately as well.
If we can go back then to what you mentioned earlier, was you called it rhinovirus, and its effect on people who work with horses and the horses themselves. Can you sort of talk us through? I don't know if you have like an outline of how it sort of transpired almost in real time, but can you explain the way that any particular incident was sort of handled from beginning to end, and then what kind of after the fact happened?
Sure. You know, in the past 10 years, there's been several examples of rhinovirus outbreaks at competitions that have happened throughout the country, or rhinopneumonitis outbreaks. And so a couple of them happened in the state of Florida, also Utah, elsewhere in the country. So it's not specific to us. But, you know, the ideal response and what has happened is that that single case is identified. It's called the index case in the terminology of biosecurity and infectious disease. And when that index case is identified, then measures go into place to identify if there's been any transmission to secondary animals. And we use what we know about that disease, whatever disease it may be, about incubation times, about the types of clinical signs that animals show, and we start to monitor for those things. And you want to set restrictions on that monitoring and perhaps even on the transit of animals in and out of an area based on what you know about incubation time. So, you know, in an ideal situation, you may know that the incubation time is up to 14 days. So you would like these animals to essentially stay put in that period of time while you're watching for any additional cases, instead of allowing them to leave and potentially take a infection that has not become clinical yet and take that home to expose other animals there. And there's pretty well-documented guidelines for that in that type of setting. Honestly, what some of the best managed situations are at horse shows and at sales at this point, because that's a public venue and there's state guidelines. You know, a small farm has less to go on. You know, they seek the advice of their veterinarian, but there's not as much of a documented process in place. And sometimes that's where things can break down.
Well, we're talking in this circumstance about this rhinovirus, but that sounds like veterinarians already have a pretty decent understanding of how that particular virus affects animals. What if we talk about something that is a little bit less well known in terms of how exactly it's spread and what some of the symptoms are and what some of the possible negative effects could be?
Sure. I mean, that is certainly a frustrating situation if you're to be dealing with a horse that is ill and it's not clear what the cause of that is. Ideally in that sort of a scenario, until you've ruled out what is known to be easily contagious or contagious from horse to horse, you would like to see the rest of the animals on that farm not go anywhere. And, you know, we certainly treat cases like that that present to us at the hospital. This one particular horse is quite ill, comes in to see us, and we say, okay, you probably need to keep everybody else at home until we get to the bottom of this. And we can tell you for sure whether or not they're at risk. Mm. And that's certainly how we handle that at the outset. Identifying new infectious diseases is probably a whole other radio show, but there are good examples of that in the past few years. You know, West Nile virus was something that was first seen actually in zoo animals in New York in 2001, and now it's a viral infection that's essentially ubiquitous across the country. And so that process of identifying what that cause was pretty lengthy and complicated. And until they knew what the infectious cause was, it wasn't clear whether other animals were directly at risk or not.
And I would like to talk about that case specifically in a little bit if we can, because in effect that has had there's been great success in treating that, right?
Absolutely.
So, but circling back around to, say, a horse show scenario in which, you know, there's a lot of interests involved, right? People mm-hmm. want to put on these shows, so there's folks who have a stake there. You've got the participants who have worked hard for this and are proud of what they're doing, and you've got a lot of people who are maybe even spectators who are looking forward to it as well. Have there ever been circumstances in which there has been any pushback from the economic interests involved?
I think it would be very of course, there's economic interest, but ultimately, everyone that's a player in the equine arena, it realizes the larger implications of these kinds of situations. And even if there's a short-term economic impact to respond appropriately to these outbreaks, the long-term benefit to preventing a worsening situation from occurring, people see the long-term benefit of responding appropriately. I think it would be you'd be being too innocent to say economics never come into it. But the equine industry is in the end led by people that are horse owners, horse lovers, and they have that industry and the health of the long-term industry health at the heart of their concerns as well. And so at this point, I think what you're finding in the industry is people respond appropriately. They want to contain any sort of outbreak that's occurring. They want to identify what needs to be happening to prevent it from happening again, do our best to prevent. Some of these things are not preventable, which is the scariest part about it, but trying to put the right measures into place. And what we've learned as these outbreaks have occurred over the last 10 or 15 years is trying to ignore them is not effective, because if you allow that competition to continue, there will likely be secondary cases. There'll be horses that take infections home, and completely unrelated animals can end up infected.
Mm-hmm. I have not spent a lot of time around horses, but the time that I have spent around horses, it became really evident to me very quickly the kind of human horse sort of bond that exists, right? People develop a strong relationship with horses, I think because horses are amazing animals. But if you're someone who rides horses or trains horses or whatever, there's like a really close connection between a person and a horse. I mean, let's say you're riding this horse. Well, this horse and you are really working together as a team. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that folks with horses who are facing a situation like this, it isn't merely about money, but it has a lot to do probably with the way that they strongly feel about their animals anyway. Even if you don't call the animal a pet per se, it is still an animal with which you have this sort of bond.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting dichotomy in our industry because there is a lot of economic value and economic play in the industry. There's, a lot of services which are paid for and animals that are bought and sold. But ultimately, the people that are involved in this industry are doing it for the love of the horse, the love of competition, the love of the sport. Because there's not a good way to make money in the horse industry. So they really do have the horse's welfare in mind as well.
Yeah. So when we talk about something like, say, West Nile or even Tripoli, I don't know if that's relevant as well. You mentioned West Nile as something that kind of, in a way, did it seem to come out of nowhere?
To some extent, it did, because it was sort of first seen in this country as a foreign disease. You know, the clinical signs and the symptoms didn't totally match anything that had happened before, and the diagnostic tests weren't giving them the answer because they were looking for things that you would expect to happen in this country. And so identifying what the cause of those initial cases were was challenging. But then once it was found, it was then a disease that pretty quickly spread across the country. It's mosquito transmitted, and so those mosquitoes are pretty prevalent across the country. And as soon as it got into that population and was cycling between mosquitoes and birds, it was pretty easily sent across the U.S. and now is prevalent across the entire country. And so it is a great example of a sort of a biosecurity response where they were able to identify the etiology and ultimately were able to develop vaccinations for some animals that get West Nile, including horses. And that's all an ideal response that we'd like to see.
How long did it take from sort of beginning to end?
Well, we had a vaccine about 5 years after the 5 or 6 years after the disease first was identified in this country for horses. And it took probably another 7, 8, 9 years before it traveled completely across the country to where you were seeing cases in California.
Mm-hmm.
It started on the east coast of the U.S. And certainly areas where there's mosquitoes, it's more prevalent. So there's that component. But seasonally, there's mosquitoes across the whole country. So it just took enough cycles of summers to get across the country.
Now, don't let me stray too far off topic here, but with something like a vaccine for, say, West Nile, are there fewer hurdles to jump in terms of getting a product out onto the market that can really do a lot to stop this condition from spreading because we're not talking about human beings?
That's actually a great question. It's interestingly, yes, it's a little bit less restrictive as compared to licensing of a human vaccine. There is a layer of approval that is related to proving safety but not efficacy for new animal vaccines that are considered sort of emerging diseases. And it is a problem that we need an urgent solution to. And that is actually what the first West Nile virus vaccine was released under. The company that developed it was able to show it was not dangerous to the animals that received it in experimental trials. They did not have to initially prove that it was effective because of the need for the vaccine. So they were able to release it. It was used. And then over the course of the next couple of years, they did the experimental studies that were required to show that it was effective. And that's part of that approval is that it's short term because you do eventually have to prove efficacy to keep it on the market. But it allowed the vaccine to get to market that much faster. There's an interesting example that it happened around the same time. Another disease of horses that has a much more complicated infectious process called EPM, which I think we might have talked about on this show before, but it's also a neurologic disease and it's spread by possums. And a vaccine was released under the same method of, is it safe? Yes, we'll release the vaccine, now we have to prove it's effective around the same time. And that vaccine was subsequently pulled off the market because it was shown to not be. So the system works. The vaccines are available. They're not going to hurt the horses, and we'd like to think they help. And then ultimately, they are either shown to work or not and pulled from the market if they're not working.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill. I'm speaking today with Dr. Martha Malicote from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about biosecurity, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Martha Malicote from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking about biosecurity, and we've spoken about some specific incidents, and we've spoken a little bit about, generally speaking, what biosecurity is all about. But let's talk about something that is maybe relevant to folks who not only are in our community, but folks in general who think about horses and the role that they play on a smaller scale. And so we might talk about folks even around here who have horses, and doesn't have to necessarily be a huge operation, but what is the average sort of horse owner, what is that person's part in all of this, and how might he or she effectively implement biosecurity?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a few key things that we can put into play to allow, you know, any size farm to have a good means of preventing infectious disease. One of the first steps that is not always doable, but is ideal if it's possible, is to separate the various animal populations on the farm, if that's relevant or possible. Now, if you have three horses, you're not separating them. But if you have 20 and say five of them are brood mares that don't leave the farm, and five of them are show horses that leave the farm every week, and the other 10 are young horses in training. If I could put my ideal scenario together, those 20 horses would not live together. They would live in separate parts of the facility, ideally, or at least with some amount of separation, so that if the horses that did travel brought home something from a show or a sale or what have you, that wouldn't immediately be so easily transmitted to another population. So that's step one. Not practical for everyone. That is understandable. But if the operation is large enough, it's ideal to separate your different populations.
Can I stop you just for just a second and ask, how does separation work? Are there parameters that need to be observed, right?
Sure.
That is to say, what level of separation is there? Separate buildings altogether?
Yeah, so if I got to pick my perfect situation, which I'll be the first horse owner to admit, this is not the situation on my own farm because I don't have the means to size-wise to do that at the farm. But ideally, those populations would be housed in different barns if they're kept in barns. They would be turned out in separate paddocks, so not turned out together. And ideally, there would be about 20 to 30 feet distance at all times between those populations. So if there's pastures next to each other, that distance between the two pastures or between barns, and that's because of what we know about respiratory viral passage. And we know that when they snort, you know, that respiratory viral particles get left out into the air when they're snorting and sneezing, and we know how far that can go. And so that's hence the 20 to 30 feet distance. That is not practical for everyone. You know, if you're doing that, it's also ideal to make sure that your personnel that are moving between those areas are cleaning hands, washing hands, you know, cleaning off footwear between those facilities too. Again, not always practical when there's one person managing all those horses, but being cognizant of trying not to take something between barns is helpful. The lengths to which you can go vary, you know, but that's the ideal scenario for applying it. And then from there, the next step is that we want to be constantly monitoring for any initial signs of disease. Ideally, this is taking temperatures on all the animals on your farm every day. Again, this is not something that everyone can do, but if you ask me one single thing you can do to identify early if there's an infectious disease on the farm, it's that. Take every horse's temperature at least once a day. And that is one of my favorite things as a clinician. When I get a case in and somebody says, this horse has a fever, and here's its temperature record from the last 2 weeks. So I know this is the first day it's had a fever, as opposed to the fifth day, and it's just that today the horse looked bad enough that they checked its temperature. That's enormously helpful to me as well. So monitoring for a fever, and in a horse, that's going to be a temp over 102.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So monitoring for a fever and then looking for other signs of disease like nasal discharge. A lot of these respiratory diseases come with some nasal discharge, so we want to look for that. And then abnormal feces. So if their poop piles are soft, something like that, that's going to tell me they may have a GI infection. And then also just looking at the horse's overall state. You know, is their heart rate, their pulse increased? That's harder to just identify from looking at them, but if you look at the horse, you can see if they're breathing fast just from looking at their flanks. And so watching for those things are also helpful. At minimum, temperatures are great, but if you can look at all those signs, that's even better, and identify early when there's a problem.
Now, taking the temperature of a lot of horses sounds kind of like a time-consuming task. If you're doing it every day, it becomes that's something that almost requires a full-time person taking care of all of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, you know, you can – if you take temperatures at a time that the horses are all close in anyway, say, for instance, you feed grain once or twice a day while the horses are all eating, if you run down the row and take their temperatures, it'll probably take you a minute or 2 minutes per horse. It adds to the length of your day, but it is worthwhile to identify those problems early, because the minute that horse has a fever, that one case, you can pull them out of your general population. Even if it's not like you're loading the horse up to bring it to a referral facility, you can pull that horse out of the general population, separate him, and call your veterinarian to have him come take a closer look.
Mm-hmm. But it also involves record keeping.
Absolutely.
Right. You got to have a notebook, or I don't know, maybe mm-hmm. some enterprising horse owner has developed an app where you just have like a list of your horses and each day you enter.
There are a variety of apps and computer-based health monitoring systems actually now. But there is some record keeping involved, whether it's on your phone or on a piece of paper. It definitely does require that.
Mm-hmm. And then while you're, so far we've got the gauging the horse's temperature, kind of keeping track of how they are doing and what some of them might be doing that's a little bit unusual, signs of sickness. We've got the process of just keeping them separate if possible. Where do we go from there?
So from there, the other thing that is really key is making sure that you do the things you need to do to keep these horses healthy, sort of from a preventative care point of view. And the easy answer to that is vaccines, and that's part of the program for sure. You and I have actually talked about vaccination before, and that is a part of keeping them healthy, is making sure that they're current on the appropriate vaccines. But also it's a matter of keeping the horse generally systemically healthy, that they are on a good diet, they're at a good weight, they're not overweight, they're not underweight, they're appropriately being treated for GI parasites. Also that if you have any members of the population that are very old or very young, you're addressing health issues that come with that. Certainly older horses are at risk of several different endocrine disorders that can have an impact on their ability to fight off infection. So managing those things can be an important part of preventing infectious disease, especially if you have a barn full of retired horses. That can come into play as well. So keeping their general health in a good state is key. And then the vaccination piece is also certainly important. There are vaccines for some of the things that we are worried about, transmission, certainly respiratory viral diseases. There are vaccines for the prevention of that. And so using those strategically, you know, based on your horse population's travel schedules and lifestyle, that's a discussion you can have with your veterinarian about your specific situation, is also pretty key.
I would imagine that the larger the operation, the more important it is to institute some of these steps, right?
Sure. I mean, the last thing I want is a respiratory virus to run through 100 young horses in training, and not to minimize the 5-horse pleasure barn of, you know, people that just have them to go trail riding and enjoy their horses. But it's certainly a bit bigger impact when we're talking about 100 young horses that have a specific training schedule and need to stay on that schedule. That can be very devastating in that situation.
Plus just the challenge of then treating 100 horses versus, say, treating 5.
Absolutely.
In terms of cost and in terms of time and so much more. If we talk about some of these steps, and if we hypothetically have a scenario in which there is full compliance, best case scenario, can you say that you will likely prevent the spread of most diseases?
Yes. Yeah, if you're able to institute these things, even if you're not able to separate horse populations, identifying the clinical signs of disease at the beginning of the infection can have a huge impact on the prevention of it getting worse. If you can separate your horse populations, even better, in terms of even the worst case scenario, quote unquote, won't involve your whole farm. It will involve those few animals that are kept together.
We just talked about these different steps or different things that horse owners and farms should do. I wonder, though, if we didn't maybe discuss them kind of in an inverse order. Because let us say that you're talking to just anybody who may have horses. Well, it almost goes without saying now that you really should be giving vaccines,
mm-hmm.
having your horse on a regular vaccine schedule. And as you said, we've discussed this topic before. And then next, after that, certainly, you do, no matter what, you want to be looking after the health of your horse and watching out for any signs that that may be unusual. Going the other way around, while it seems like it is a great idea if you can to have your horse population sort of separated, that alone isn't going to do anything if they aren't vaccinated and if no one is looking after how they're feeling.
Absolutely. No, that's a very good observation. We you know, all of these components ideally need to be in place. And if you can only select some of them, I'm probably the least concerned about things like keeping the population separate. But, you know, in an ideal situation of how you're going to implement, that would be part of it.
Mm. So let us say that all of these have been observed, that the horses are in an environment in which there is enough space where they can have their own areas. Let us say that the vaccines are given on a regular basis. And let us say that there are trainers around who look after the horses and any sort of any things that look not so right are taken care of right away. But let us say that something then does come up. Maybe a horse on the farm goes off to do a show and then comes back. What happens then? Certainly you treat that horse. Do you quarantine that horse?
That's actually a great question. And the next thing I was going to point out is how you handle new animals coming onto the farm also has impact on this. And whether it's a completely foreign animal or it's an animal that lives on the farm that has traveled to a competition, is returning, how you handle that animal when it returns can be key as well. If it is a completely new arrival to the farm, ideally that animal is quarantined when it first arrives at the farm. It's kept completely separate from everything else on your property. How long? If I got to pick, I would want it to be at least 3 weeks. That is not practical for everyone. I realize that. I get to tell you what you should do, and then people can apply what they're able to do. But ideally, it's going to be at least 3 weeks. And during that period of time, that horse should be closely watched to make sure that they don't develop a fever or have any other of the signs we were talking about of an infection. There are even more extensive routes you can go with in terms of testing that horse for some of the infectious diseases that we worry about most. And that's not something you need to do in every scenario, but it is an option that you can talk to your veterinarian about depending upon where that horse came from. If you feel comfortable about the person you purchased it from versus acquiring the horse from a bad situation perhaps, or a neglectful or rescue type situation, you may be a little bit more intensive in looking for infectious disease before you let them into your general population. So that's one key to keep in mind. But then, you have a horse that travels to a competition and comes back, it's not realistically very practical to say every time they return they get quarantined for 3 weeks, because before the quarantine's over, they're probably going to another show. But that's where keeping animals into separate populations can be helpful, because those ones that travel a lot, they come back to their buddies that also travel. And if they were, unfortunately, to bring back, say, a respiratory viral infection with them, it's not going to go immediately over to your broodmares, for instance. And these horses that travel are hopefully well protected with the vaccines in a strategic way so that they're least likely to bring these things back, and that will help them as well. So how you're handling a completely foreign and new horse on the farm is a little bit more aggressive than the one that travels to a show and returns and then just hopefully continues to hang out with his competition buddies.
For sure. Now, when we're talking about an environment in which maybe this horse has gone to a show in which there has been identified a problem.
Mm-hmm.
What then? Any special things to do when the horse returns? Quarantine, certainly.
Mm-hmm. But ideally, yeah. If they've identified what the cause is of the problem, where the horse is coming from, that can give you a little more specifics about how long the horse should be monitored for clinical signs. For most of our respiratory viruses, it's between 10 and 14 days. So if it was that period of time, we try to take temperatures on the horse every day for that long. Ideally, keeping them separate would be what we'd want to see happen. If the horses were allowed to leave from the competition venue, there wasn't a quarantine put in place there. There's some assurance that the outbreak is not of a concern that they aren't allowing the animals to leave. The bigger danger is honestly where no one identifies a disease until after horses leave the farm, leave the show, what have you. That's the bigger concern. But if you have a known possibility, that horse needs to be quarantined and closely watched. The worst case scenario than that, though, is the horse that actually just develops clinical signs of overt disease at your farm. A great example of this is a condition called strangles, is the sort of lay term for it. It's an infection with strep equi bacteria. And that bacteria has a special predilection to cause abscesses in the lymph nodes under a horse's jaw and also fills up a space that is a unique anatomical location in the horse that's between their jaw and their ear called the guttural pouch. And they'll get kind of a thick infection in that area as well, the same sort of stuff that comes out of the abscesses in the lymph nodes. And that's a very commonly kind of transmitted thing at a show. The horse comes home, and then a week later, you've got tons of nasal discharge, and you're like, uh-huh, I suspect that's what it is. So we need to identify, is that in fact it, which is the first step, having your veterinarian help you with that. But then we need to put in place sort of an outbreak management plan for that situation. That horse that has clinical signs needs to get quarantined separately. And then from there, we tend to divide the rest of the farm into two categories, exposed to that horse but not showing clinical signs, and then unexposed. And those need to be separated. Again, I realize this is sometimes a big plan to try to put into place, but can be really helpful in shortening the period of time that the outbreak occurs. So you've got these multiple populations of horses, and then you have to put in periods of time. We're going to wait, you know, until the index case, that first horse is recovered from his clinical signs. Then we have to think about how long could those exposed animals go before they would be expected to show signs, or we could say they're normal, and then we clear them out to the third group of not exposed at all. So you end up having three tiers of animals, basically.
How are these different parameters or sort of policies devised, and who kind of helps the horse owner along with a plan to mitigate any of the trouble that may exist?
Absolutely. Your veterinarian is key to that because they have a lot of familiarity with specific infectious diseases and how they behave in terms of how long they incubate, how long they will show clinical signs. Some of the diseases that are more common, and strangles, the one example I just gave you, is one of these for the state of Florida, as well as some of the other things we've talked about today, are considered what's called reportable diseases, which means the veterinarian is obligated to report to the state vet that there is a case. And the reason for that is that, you know, Florida has a fair amount of precautions put into place to help us prevent getting a widespread outbreak of disease in this state. We have the horse population has a significant impact on the economics of this state. And so because of realizing that potential impact of a widespread disease outbreak, there are restrictions put in place by the state vet when quarantines need to happen. So for instance, because strangles is reportable, if I call up the state vet and I tell him I have a case, then they also get in contact with the horse owner and put a quarantine on that location and monitor the recovery of the animals and the resolution of the situation. And that's just because of the importance of it to the whole state. The state vets, as a result, can be another good resource. For several of these diseases that are common, we have kind of a set plan, what you should do. And the state veterinarian's office can be a great resource in helping to implement that as well.
I'm so glad that you circled back around to that, because earlier in the show when you talked about the state veterinarian's role in putting into place some actions when it seems like something is going wrong, I wasn't even fully aware of what kind of scenarios would warrant that kind of action. Mm-hmm. When this takes place, the horse owners are presumably obligated to follow the directions?
Yes. For the most part, it is a friendly conversation. It's not typically an adversarial one. But yes, the state mandated quarantines are a mandate. They are obligated to do it. Some of this is related to this idea of horse owners ultimately have the horse's best interest at heart for the most part, and so they're willing to abide by those quarantines. But yes, it is a mandate. When it's a reportable disease and the state veterinarian's office is involved, they are required to follow the quarantine regulations that are put into place. And usually it's a discussion of between the veterinarian and the state vet's office, and particularly if horse owners are not adversarial about it. It's a friendly conversation. It's not a negative discussion, but they kind of put a plan together that's practical and realistic.
Let us say we're talking about a situation in which a horse owner has come from a great distance, right? And has come in and maybe that person's horse has been exposed to something and is maybe even showing signs of having, you know, acquired whatever it may be. Does that person leave with the horse, or is that person kind of there for a while?
They're stuck at times, yeah. And that can be a problem. If you particularly consider the transient horse population we have that comes in the spring and winter here to show and compete, they will plan to come to stay for a few months. And I have personally treated horses that have been kind of quote-unquote stuck here because of whatever is going on with them. And in order to exit and to leave the state of Florida, horses are required to have a veterinary health certificate and one proof of one test. It's called a Coggins test. It's for an equine infectious anemia. Those two things are required for all horses entering and exiting the state. There are agricultural inspection stations at every route of exit. So those horses are not supposed to leave if they are ill. They're supposed to stay put and not take that with them.
When it comes to buying and selling horses, or when it comes to breeding horses, do horse owners or the folks who have a stake in these transactions, do they look at how well the other farm implements biosecurity before proceeding with any sort of interaction or transaction?
It's certainly part of the discussion. It's not the only thing, certainly, but it is part of the discussion. Interestingly, that's a great question, and it's something that gets applied a whole lot more in herd type animals. So if you were buying a herd of cattle or you were buying a herd of goats, you would probably be even more diligent in making certain that specific tests have been done and specific diseases were negative because of the potential implications of buying 50 animals that had this infectious disease, as opposed to most horse transactions are a single animal. So we assess them for health. We assess that they're coming from a good environment. But interestingly, there's a little less use of that than there is compared to some of the other production herd type large animal things that happen.
For very valuable animals, let's say a racehorse or some sort of show horse or a competition animal that does go around a lot, but is an animal that generates revenue in a way that some horses sometimes can. Are the measures that are put in place for biosecurity that much more rigorous?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly those horses are all very well managed from a perspective of appropriate vaccinations. They're very well managed in terms of their mode of transit, and the type of travel they do is designed to keep them as healthy as possible. For instance, we know that travel in a horse trailer of greater than 8 hours, if the horse's head is tied during that transit, they can't lower their head and cough in order to clear their airways, they are much more likely to get particularly infectious diseases, respiratory infectious diseases. So those horses are ideally not being transported in a situation that's a small trailer that their head is tied for that length of time. That's one example of a specific thing that can be put into place to help prevent. But beyond that, it's a bit of a risk we take. And it's a scary risk if you think about the fact that these are extremely high-level horses that we're sometimes shipping. Rio is a great example, to the Olympics. And they could potentially be exposed to something, despite the best management being in place. That's the downside to our sport, I suppose.
As a veterinarian, where do you see the future of biosecurity? Are there going to be more and more infectious diseases that become a concern? Are new strategies going to be implemented in order to combat the spread of infectious disease?
Well, I guess to the part of your question about strategy, yes, and that's something that's already come into play. We've had several high-profile disease outbreaks at competitions in the last 5 years or so, and there's much, much more attention being paid to horse owners about how they're going to handle those situations, how they can identify them early, that sort of thing. And that's already happening, which is great. The other downside to that, though, is that, yes, I do think that we'll see more problems. And part of that is because of the changing climates and temperatures, the particular populations of vectors, for example. Mosquitoes are a great example of this, are able to live in places they maybe couldn't live in 15 years ago because of the slight increases in temperatures. This is happening in Europe right now with association with a disease called blue tongue virus in ruminants, so cattle, goats, and sheep. And there are parts of Europe that have blue tongue that have never had blue tongue before, and it's because the specific mosquitoes that carry it are now living in those parts of Europe. And we're going to continue to see those kinds of things. Previously, it was thought that perhaps Zika virus couldn't survive in the mosquitoes that are found in the U.S. And that doesn't seem to be the case because we have locally transmitted infections. And that will continue to be a problem, changing areas of infectious disease because of changing climate.
Briefly, does, however, it help to have the sort of means of communication that we have today in which telecommunications and word can spread quickly, veterinarians can get training from all over the place and be on top of some of this stuff?
Yes, and that's actually a great question, and you're reminding me of something I should have already mentioned, and that is that, yes, it can be a great modes of transmission, but it's important that it's valuable information be transmitted kind of accurately and appropriately. And the industry has responded to that and have set up some consortiums that are doing infectious disease outbreak notifications now. And so it's not just about reading it in media, which can be a great resource. I'm not, you know, trying to be critical of media, but it's good to make sure that it's accurate information. And so for equine specific information, there is something called the EDCC, the Equine Disease Communication Center, and it's being put together by several different industry groups, but headed up by the AAEP, which is the American Association of Equine Vets. And that website is basically a depository for all sorts of infectious diseases across the country. And you can get email alerts about what's going on and know if there's an outbreak somewhere. And it's valid information. It's submitted primarily by state veterinarians' offices, so you know it's accurate. It's not just hearsay. And it's a great tool. And that's a great example of kind of the technology we have being helpful.
A tool not only for folks like you who treat horses, but maybe even for concerned owners and trainers as well.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Martha Malico from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back and talking to me again. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Always happy to do it.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey and her staff at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, of course, and to Richard Drake and to Luke Tia as well. I'm Dana Hill. We'll be back next time with another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.